just to recap on one or two things that we talked about last week, seismic velocity varies because of composition, in particular how much iron is in the olivine. The more iron, the more iron, the lower the seismic velocity. The state, whether it's molten or solid, if something is molten, then the seismic wave speed will reduce. Temperature, if the temperature is high, seismic wave speed will reduce. And also the mineral phase, but this tends to be dependent on pressure, so it's kind of depth dependent. If you went horizontally in the middle of the upper mantle, you wouldn't expect to see changes in wave speed because of mineral phase, because you'd only expect to see those in the vertical as you go down and pressure increases. Did anybody go to yesterday's research seminar? I was hoping that one or two people might, because the speaker gave a very good lecture, but did what almost everybody does, everybody who's in the sort of interpretive field, and that was to assume that seismic wave speed was just a proxy for temperature. And that's not correct, and it's very easy to show that that's not correct. Okay. So I emphasised this last week, that you can't assume that seismology is a proxy for temperature. And I also pointed out that the 650 discontinuity impedes convection, but we're not sure how much by. So if we look at seismic slices of the upper and lower mantles, then they're very different. So I'm just going to explore a little bit what seismology can tell us about the mantle, which we're certain of, and what some of the pitfalls are. So seismologists spend a lot of their time trying to produce these nice colour cross-sections for geologists, so that we can see slabs going down and we can see hot diapirs rising up and this kind of thing. But these things are actually, we're beginning to realise that these things are quite suspect. Up until now, the way seismology has been done is that somebody will go and study Yellowstone or something like that, or somebody will go and study Hawaii or Iceland, and there'll be an experiment there which shows the results. And what people tend not to do is to go back and repeat the experiment. Well, you wouldn't get funding for that. But now there's so much equipment out for such a long period of time, so many graduate students wanting projects, that we're starting to see a lot of repeat experiments, a lot of people taking data and trying to see if they get the same as the previous guy who published a paper. And we're beginning to realise that people are getting different answers. So this is very worrisome. And myself and a group of colleagues recently wrote a paper called Caveats on Seismic Tomography, where we pointed out some of the difficulties in that. And I've posted a little link to that on the Twitter stream, and also a simplified version of it that we wrote for a broader audience. So this is from the work of a seismologist who's at MIT, and this shows slices through the mantle at different depths. So this is 100 kilometers depth. This is what the seismic wave speed looks like at 100 kilometers depth. Blue is high wave speed and red is low wave speed. This is 300 kilometers, this is 550, and this is 650. So this is where the discontinuity is. Okay. And this is 690. So you can see that at the very shallow depths, we're looking at something which is looking a little bit like what we see on the surface. Here we have North America, here we have South America, here we have Asia, and here is Australia, and here is Africa, and here is Antarctica. So the areas that are continents with thick continental lithosphere are more or less in blue, and most of the oceanic areas are in red. So as we go down, this pattern kind of generally persists. Here's the Pacific Ocean, Asia, North, South America, so on, Australia, Antarctica. And you can see this pattern kind of more or less persists as you go down in depth until you go below 650, and then you see all of a sudden that it's very different. And as you go through the lower mantle, 690, 790, 900, 1300, 1800, It looks very different, and the wave speeds are very, there's not a big extreme. At shallow depth, it's an extreme. extreme difference between the fast and the slow. In the mid-mantle here, it's more or less all the same, and it doesn't look anything, there's no real correlation with the surface. But then when you get down to greater depths, and when you get down to the core mantle boundary, this is 2,500 kilometres, all of a sudden this pattern seems to re-emerge. Okay? So here we have North America, South America, here we have the Pacific, and here we have Asia, and Antarctica, and Australia. So people have looked at this and they've said, that looks like the surface. Why is that? Why is the core mantle boundary like the surface, but the stuff in between isn't? What can be going on? Is there a connection between the core mantle boundary or not? And actually, I've been looking at this quite recently, and if you look at it carefully, you kind of think to yourself, well, is there a correlation? You just glance at it quickly, it's always a correlation, but if you look at it carefully, none of South America really is fast. This part of Europe isn't fast. This part of Africa isn't fast. So it would be a very interesting project, and Africa's not fast, it's red. So it would be a very interesting project to actually numerically, statistically correlate the continents, the edge of the continents and the lower mantle. Mantle boundary and see how strong the correlation is, because it's very easy to fool yourself, and then you find that you're launching a big research program to try to find out why X is the case, and then at some point somebody points out that it's not the case if you look at it correctly. So anyway, I was trying to get a group of students in the maths department to do this this year, but they thought it was a little bit too hard for them, so they decided not to. But the maths professor and I were trying to get together a couple of interns to do this project this summer, and if maths can get the funding, then I'll be looking for an earth science student to do an internship working on this project, basically. So this is looking at the problem in frequency domain. So this is essentially frequency, angular degree, and this is depth from the surface down to the bottom, and this is looking at the kind of frequency content of these models, and there again you can see that the surface, the spectrum, the surface region here looks a little bit like the core mantle boundary, not exactly, because you can see there's a lot of energy here in the smaller wavelengths, and that doesn't exist at the core mantle boundary. So it's not exactly the same, but it's more similar between the surface and the core mantle boundary than the surface and the mid-mantle. It's quite interesting. This is the gentleman who did this work. So let's look at some cross-sections, and you see various things if you look at cross-sections. This is Jeroen Ritsema, who did a lot of work doing whole mantle tomography and looking at the structure of the entire planet. And this comes from his model, so he's very generous with his model. He shares his model, and he also distributes software so that anybody can load up this software and they can make cross-sections through his model wherever they want. This is a cross-section through Iceland. So here we have a cross-section running from North America to Europe here. And in the middle is Iceland, so this is what we see. This is the North Atlantic. And this is what's seen in whole mantle tomography, which is looking at things on a kind of spatial scale of about 1,000 kilometres. So if there was a mantle plume that went from the surface down to the bottom and it was 200 kilometres wide, you would not see it. But this is what's seen in this model. A very strong anomaly which goes down to the 650 discontinuity, but it doesn't continue on any further down. You'll see a lot of pictures like this, which, so this is the surface, and this is the core mantle boundary, this is the Earth's core, and this is what the thickness of the mantle looks like. We could do tomography on lots of different scales, and I've worked in most of these scales myself. We could do what Jeroen Ritsema did and do it on a global scale, and you could sit in your armchair and do the whole planet. We can now do continental scale, just in recent years, because governments have put large amounts of money into this. And we can also work on a regional scale and do something known as teleseismic tomography. So let's talk about these three types of tomography. So when you search up your papers on Samoa and Iceland and Yellowstone and so forth, you need to bear in mind, was this a local study? Was it a continental-wide study? Or was it a global study? And depending on what kind of study it is, you'd expect to see a scale of anomalies that's different. So on a global scale, you'll see anything smaller than about 1,000 kilometres you won't see. On a continental scale, anything that's smaller than, say, 200-300 kilometres, you would not expect to see. If in the case of regional teleseismic tomography, you would not expect to see something that was smaller than, say, 20 kilometres across. These are kind of rules of, you know, kind of ballpark figures. Okay, we've got some problems. So in case of global seismology, you know, you can just imagine your own head as being a proxy for the Earth, okay? So we have a skull, we've got a brain inside. Hopefully our brains are bigger proportionately to our heads than the Earth's core is, to proportion to the planet. But, you know, if you had something wrong with your head, you had a brain tumour, something like that, then you'd go to hospital and you would be scanned, wouldn't you? And they'd want to get a three-dimensional picture of your brain so that they could design an operation. Well, the way to get the best possible, most accurate picture would be to have your entire head full of energy sources and sensors. That would be the best possible thing. Of course, that's not possible because we can't fill the brain with sources. Of course, in the case of some illnesses, they can inject you with something which has got a very benign radionuclide in it, and that material will cluster in some part of your body, and it can be imaged like that, so you've got sources inside you. In the case of the Earth, we're dealing with seismic stations that we could put out, and we're dealing with earthquakes that occur. And by no means is the Earth full of earthquakes and full of sensors. It's not. There are no earthquakes deeper than about 700 kilometres. In fact, there are even very few earthquakes down there. And the earthquakes that do occur in very narrow belts. They're not evenly distributed across the whole Earth. It's the same with seismic sensors. We have seismic sensors on the surface, so there are lots in America, there are lots in Europe, for example, not so many in South America, very few in Antarctica. So the network of seismic stations we have is very sparse, and they're all obviously on the surface of the Earth. So we have a problem that there are many regions inside the Earth where the rays from earthquakes to sensors don't go. There are lots of kind of blind spots in the Earth. Here's what the permanent global network looks like. So you can see in this whole big region here of the Earth, you know, there are only about 10 stations. And this whole region here is completely devoid of any seismic stations. Tristan has got one station. So here is a kind of random picture showing certain rays that go from earthquakes to stations, and where these rays have passed, there's some information about the Earth from along the path. And you can see these are direct S waves, and you can see that there's just a big hole here, and there's a big hole here, and there's a big hole here, and there's very little here. But on the other hand, from here to here is extremely dense. So it's very non-uniform. Can anybody say why we've got this interesting thing happening here in the middle? What is there?
Hawaii?
Yes, Hawaii. There's a seismic station on Hawaii. And here we've got the rays that got the globe like this. We've got so-called SS, which goes bonk, bonk. Okay. So the S wave will go directly from the earthquake to the station, and the double S will bounce off the surface and then go to the station. So these are, you know, not particularly special cases. I've just taken these as examples. And you can see this is another ray that Jeroen Ritsema used in his model. And you can see there's a huge number of rays here because of the earthquake station distribution, but other areas are more poorly sampled. So repeatability is a problem. You may already have come across this problem if you dredged through the literature looking for seismic tomography images of Iceland. Iceland, for example, then you'll find a big range of results. Here we have a cross section which goes through Samoa. Samoa group would be interested in this. And here is one picture where the worker has analysed these data and has concluded that there are several plumes here. And here's another one from a different model where you can see some qualitative similarity. This is the same cross section. So we've got a high wave speed thing here, we've got a high wave speed thing here. We've got a kind of big broad low wave speed thing here, which these workers concluded is divided up in this way here. And you know, which is correct. Until everybody agrees on certain features, you know, it's difficult to know what is right. We've got some more examples. This is a cross-section around the whole world. And it goes through Australia, it goes through North America, where we should expect to see the subducted Farallon slab. And if we look at the Farallon slab, or where we think the Farallon slab should be, then it should be a high wave speed thing. And there's a lot of discussion about whether the Farallon slab has subsided down to the core mantle boundary or not. Important issue. So what we want to know is, does the Farallon slab just lie in the upper mantle here, or does it go down to the core mantle boundary? And if you look at these different ones, okay, then there is a high wave speed anomaly here in some of them, which looks slab-like. In others it doesn't exist in the upper mantle, and in others it's just a very broad region. These are six different independent models. Continent scale tomography, this is something quite new. Over the last 10 years or so, the United States has basically covered the whole country with seismic stations. So this is a kind of unprecedented experiment called US Array. And what they did was to install a big swathe of stations here. And over a period of about 10 years, they just took them up and just leapfrogged them across. So this, an array about this wide, just basically marched across the country like this. So these stations were not all installed simultaneously, but there was overlap. So this is all online, and lots and lots and lots of seismologists are just downloading these data and doing interesting experiments. So I mean, it's fantastic for the science, but it's kind of a little bit disappointing that it's not necessary to do any field work anymore, because you can just download it from online. I've done a lot of field work in my time, but you could do lots of seismology without needing to do any nowadays. So this is installing a seismic station, quite a big deal. The backhoe and large trench has to be dug. And I'm just going to mention Yellowstone, because a lot of people, of course, have downloaded the data and they've studied the Yellowstone area, because we want to know if there's a plume under Yellowstone. So where is the Yellowstone group? Okay, this bit is for you. So Yellowstone, here is Yellowstone Park. Everybody should go there if they possibly can. It's a truly amazing place, completely unique in the world, really. And going back from Yellowstone is what's known as the Eastern Snake River Plain, this region here. And the Eastern Snake River Plain is just blanketed with basalt. You think you're in Iceland when you're driving along here. And this basalt has erupted. It's just erupting continuously, you know, geologically speaking, along the whole of this this plain. However, there's evidence for very large silicic calderas back here. This one, and they seem to be time progressive. So Yellowstone is currently active, and this one here was active 2 or 3 million years ago, and this one was active maybe 5 or 6 million years ago, 7 or 8 million years ago, and 13 million years ago. So the silicic calderas, the old Yellowstones, the old extinct Yellowstones, they are time progressive along the plain, but the current volcanism isn't. So the silicic volcanism is time progressive, but not the basaltic volcanism. So it's quite a puzzle. Lots of people have tried to image this seismically to find out if there's a plume there or not. And a group run by Pavlis, led by Pavlis in the United States, recently took these models, because what you'll find when you look for these seismic models, you'll see this person's published that, this person published this, this person's published that, and the cross sections are all different, the colour scales are all different, the depths are all different, and this and that and the other, and these papers have all sort of chosen their own cross section, so you don't get to choose. If you're doing Yellowstone or you're doing some other, you don't get to choose what cross section you look at. You've only got, you know, half a dozen pictures in a paper that the author has chosen for you to look at. So there's a sort of transfer of knowledge problem here in seismology. But anyway, this character here, he took all these models, and some people he had to write to, especially saying, please could I have your model? You haven't put it online, you've just published these pictures. And he did a lot of reformatting and rejigging the data so that he was able, for all of these six models, to choose the same section and use the same colour scale, and published this picture here. So here we have the Eastern Snake River Plain. Okay, here we have the west coast of North America just here. So let's take a look at this one instead, shall we? Here we have the coastline. This is interpreted to be the Farallon Slab, which recently got completely subducted. Here we have the Eastern Snake River Plain, that's low wave speed, and at its front end here, this is where Yellowstone is. So the Eastern Snake River Plain has got a very strong low wave speed anomaly under all of it, which is about 100 or 200 kilometres thick. And then at this place here, this is where you would expect to see a plume if one exists. So here we've got something a little bit plume-like here, which goes down to, it's not too clear how far it goes down, but maybe that's 800 kilometres or something like that. In this one, we don't see that at all. We don't see all this busyness here, all these little anomalies. We just see broad anomalies, and there's nothing red down there. Here we see the Eastern Snake River Plain. So everybody sees the Eastern Snake River Plain. Everybody sees this ultra-low wave speed anomaly under the Eastern Snake River Plain. Everybody sees the Farallon Slab, to a first approximation. The Farallon Slab, Farallon Slab, Farallon Slab, Farallon Slab, Farallon Slab. And the EPR, the EPR, if you look at all these, you can see the EPR on all of these. But what you see in this region here, which is where the plume might be, is very variable. So these guys see something that looks a bit plume-like. These guys don't, they just see sort of red blobs here and there. And this one sees a big red blob here and nothing really much there. This one's more or less the same, except it sees a high wave speed body there, which this one doesn't. And this shows blobs here and something high there. So because we've got US array, because lots of groups can do the same thing, we're now beginning to see that you have to be a bit careful with tomography. If somebody, you know, publishes a result, it's really necessary to say, is everyone getting that result? And in fact, yesterday's speaker, her whole talk was, my group got this, this group got that, and I have to say that if you think these look different, you should have seen her pictures. She was seeing huge anomalies here, there and everywhere, and they were seeing nothing. And she said, you know, her whole talk was about who's right. And as is the case with this slide here, you know, we'll both have to disappoint you by saying we don't know. Yes.
Is anyone, I don't know if this works for seismic tomography, but I know they do it for petroleum seismic, adding models together to try and wipe out noise.
I mean, the bottom line really is that, yes, you could do fancy processing things, but the only stuff you can trust is what all reputable studies see. So we can trust that there's an ultra-low seismic wave speed anomaly under the Eastern Snake River Plain. We can't trust that there's a vertical conduit here. Might be, but we can't trust it from, you know, because one person sees it, others don't. So, you know, it's a little bit sad really that we've spent all these years doing this tomography, and I've spent most of my career publishing papers saying, you know, tomography shows this and this and this, only to realise later in my career that, we're over-interpreting our results. The method is not as powerful as we thought. We've still got a long way to go before we can use it effectively. effectively and not be misled. Okay, slabs. Here we see an image of a slab. So this is really seeing evidence at 650, if you like, that slabs are flattening and they're creeping along 650. And I was looking at this yesterday when I was preparing the lecture, and I'll point out to you that it kind of stops here. So where has it gone? You know, we don't see it in this image. Is it there and we don't see it in the image? Or does this mark the point where subduction started in the Japan Trench? So I got out an envelope and started doing calculations on the back of it. And what you need to do is to look and see how long subduction has occurred in the Japan Trench, and then say, okay, well, it's going down at 5 centimetres a year or whatever it is. So in X tens of millions of years, how much slab should have gone down there? Somebody could do this calculation. So if say, subduction's gone on for 100 million years, I don't know, I haven't looked it up, and it's going down at 5 centimetres a year, how many thousands of kilometres of slab should be down there? And how many thousands of kilometres long is this? Is this shorter? So is there more slab here, which we just can't see in tomography for some reason? And if we can't see it, why not? Problems out there. Okay, teleseismic tomography. So you'll find quite a few of these. There's one available for Hawaii. There are a lot available for Iceland. There's one available for the Galapagos group. There's stuff available for AFAR. So I think a lot of your hotspots have got this available, not for Samoa. The reason this it's not available for Samoa and it is for these other places is because you need a biggish landmass. Okay, so you have to go out there with your equipment. You have to put your seismometers down over a region that might be, say, 200 or 300 or 400 kilometres broad. I did this in Iceland. Iceland is 450 kilometres broad, so it was big enough to do an experiment like this. You can see down, roughly as far as your network is broad. Okay. So if you want to see down 200 kilometres, you have to put a network out that's at least 200 kilometres broad. And I'll show you a little video which shows how we set up one of these stations in Iceland. So I'll just pause this, because you can always replay.